Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist. This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspective. Hi, Keegan.
Hi, Madigan.
I stepped in as quickly as I could because you always say hello first.
Oh, wow. I never even thought about that.
Yeah. And I wanted to switch it up. Like, I always just kind of wait and don't say anything until you say, all right.
Man, I wonder if you're a listener, have you ever noticed that? Write in and let us know. Was this jarring for you to hear Madigan speak first?
It probably was because I was like, hi.
Yeah, very aggressive about it. Maybe that's what it was.
I didn't mean for it to be. I just didn't want to miss my opportunity, you know?
No, I'm not mad at it, actually. I like a little aggression.
It's like improv. I had to like yes and the situation, mm-hmm. just like get in there a little bit, you know?
Well, I appreciate it. Really taking that burden off me.
Such a burden before, I could tell. You're just like, oh, finally, Madigan down. Said something first. Oh. Oh, my gosh. Well, what are we talking about today, Keegan?
Well, okay. So we had decided to talk about this before the results of the 2020 election had come in, which should go to tell you that we knew exactly how this shit was about to play out.
Okay? Exactly.
We knew because Trump told us straight to our faces that he was going to contest this election no matter what happened. And we have seen a lot of parallels drawn between the 2020 election and the 2000 presidential election.
And a lot of people have gone, like, news networks have been comparing it a yes. lot. And I know yep. you're about to say there really aren't a lot of
They're
similarities.
Really not that similar, even though the Trump administration and a lot of GOP people have continued to draw those parallels. Like in our mini episode, I was talking about how the Trump administration is attempting to block the Biden administration, the incoming Biden administration, from transitioning into the White House. And I think the GSA, I can't remember what that stands for, but the government agency that kind of oversees passing along a lot of the information, especially about national security, onto uh-huh. Biden. What they are saying basically is that this is like the 2000 election. And in the 2000 election, we did not pass the information on until everything was complete.
Right.
So we are going to hold off just like we did in 2000. But the situation is very, very different today.
Yeah. So just to give a quick overview of why it's different before we get into the details of just what happened and who these people were and this whole time period, which I'm sure I remember this fairly well. Do you remember this pretty well, Keegan? Like, I wasn't that involved in politics, but I definitely remember all of this going down.
Yeah. Okay. So I was 10. So that would have made you like 8, right?
I was 8.
Yeah, in the year 2000. So what I remember is a lot of people talking about it. I remember it being on in my house. I mean, the news was on everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and this, I want to say, this was a very different time for a lot of our, like, Gen Z listeners. We didn't have social media at all. There was no being on Twitter with kind of, like, minute-by-minute updates. There was no refreshing your phone every second to look at the electoral map. So every single house had this on for days, you know,
for weeks. It was insane. And I don't remember that as much because I just didn't pay attention to the news growing up. I would just go turn on the TV and watch cartoons and do my own thing. But what I remember most, and this is something that I brought up a lot on the podcast, it was the time that I was first called a baby killer. It was when I was 8 years old third grade. And so that was kind of the first time that I became aware that some of my views may not be the same as some other people's. And I was the only kid in my class who said that their parents were voting for Gore.
I think this was the last time that my parents voted for a Democrat. My
really?
Parents voted for Gore
were
in
they
the 2000 election.
Were they Clinton fans?
They were. Well, you know, my parents just became far more conservative as they got older.
Yeah.
By the time 2004 came along, I think September 11th really changed a lot of people.
I think you're right.
My parents included. So by the time 2004 came along, I think that they were just fully on that Bush train,
yeah.
you know, at
well,
that point.
A lot of people were. So let's kind of, I wanted to talk about who these candidates are, I was going to say who they were, but they're not dead. Who they
are.
They are
alive,
they were,
yes.
But they're not our current
candidates. They're old men, but yeah.
They're old men, yes, exactly. I have a feeling that a lot of our American listeners know who George W. Bush is. He is the son of George H.W. Bush, who was a president before him. Nepotism is strong in this country.
Especially in political dynasties.
Oh, my gosh. Okay,
and that plays a role in this story as well.
It does. But speaking of political dynasties, I'm going to interject really quick because there is a documentary series on HBO Max called American Dynasties, The Kennedys. It's like a six-part series. It's really good. Really, really good.
There's a reason why families shouldn't be doing this shit. We're not a monarchy in this country. We need to stop this. On both sides of the aisle. Like, we got to stop with these, like, political dynasties, these families that just forever will just be allowed into politics because your great-grandfather was a fucking whatever. Like, enough.
I couldn't agree with you more and disagree with the concept. I completely, completely understand. Okay, so who is George Walker Bush? Did you know Walker was his middle name? I did not.
I did.
Very proud of you.
Thank you.
He was born on July 6th, 1946 in New Haven, Connecticut.
For being such a Texan, like, I feel like people really consider him to be like such Texas. And he was born in Connecticut.
He was born in Connecticut, but he was raised in Midland, Texas. So he is a Texan, but he was born in Connecticut. And his dad, who would one day be President Bush, as I said, was a law student at the time. So I think that's why they were living in Connecticut. I think that it was because his mom was there with his dad for law school.
Well, and when you look at the personas of George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush, they're very different.
Yes.
Like, if someone had told me George H.W. Bush was from Connecticut, I would be like, that makes total sense. He's got a real waspy appeal to him. Whereas you look at George W. Bush and he is this kind of like, he looks like a guy who's going to shoot finger guns at you from across the room. Like, that's his vibe.
He's the jock class clown.
Yes,
in high school, that
drunk,
just never,
which he was,
which
for
he was
years.
100%. Yeah. So he is the oldest child of his parents, George H. and Barbara Pierce. His siblings are Jeb, which we know, Neil, Marvin, and Dorothy. Oh, this is a fun fact, and I learned something about just Texas in general when I researched this. George Bush was a cheerleader in high school and in college.
I knew that. Oh, I knew that.
And, okay, so I asked Max about this, my resident Texan, and he's like, oh, yeah, my uncle was a cheerleader, too. Apparently, it's like a really normal thing in Texas for guys to be cheerleaders.
It's a little surprising. I wonder if that's the same to this day.
Because I know.
It feels like, you know, there's a lot of hyper-masculinity involved in the South.
Totally.
And in a lot of other places, having been a cheerleader myself, in Southwest Missouri, which is really not that far from Texas, like, it was very stigmatized. There were no male cheerleaders at all in any school that I competed against or was, you know, at all.
Being in the mind of George W. Bush, though, as like a high school boy, college boy, he was probably like, you know, you saw cheer, you know, it's the people that like hold the girls. He's probably looking up girls' skirts the whole time and stuff.
I saw Bring It On. That's what they do in that movie.
I've never
seen the male cheerleaders.
I've never seen Bring It On. I'm surprised you don't know this about me already. There is about a like 20-year gap of movies between like the 90s and the 2000s that I just like haven't seen. Like, there's a lot of, like, I didn't see Home Alone until 2 years ago, Forrest Gump until maybe 4 years ago. It's crazy. Like, there's just a huge like gap in my knowledge of movies, and I have a film degree, which is crazy.
I am appalled. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
I could go further. I had a few embarrassing moments in college in tests when they asked me to use an example of three movies, and all three of those movies I had ever seen. So that was really, that was fun. All right, so George W. did go to Yale and got a Bachelor of Arts in History. And like I said, he was also a cheerleader for Yale, and he was the president of his fraternity because, of course, he was. He graduated from Harvard with a business degree in 1973 and then became the governor of Texas in 1994.
Can we just pause and say, again, nepotism. Because, like, everyone knows George W. Bush. He is not known to be a brilliant academic mind.
He not
right?
that smart. He not that smart.
And yet he managed to go to Yale and Harvard. Yeah. Okay.
I should have looked up where his father went to school, but I will bet you any money that there was affiliations somewhere in his family to probably
for
both
sure.
schools
I mean, and
in some
his,
way.
His father had been the vice president and president of the United States. Okay, well, not president yet, but the vice president for sure. So.
I forgot about that. Yep. During that time. So then George became the governor of Texas in 94, and that was the same year that his brother Jeb sought to become the governor of Florida. So now George H.W. Bush has his two sons kind of like rising up the political ladder. So let's look a little bit at what George Bush was up against a little bit in this 2000 primary. So along with Bush, John McCain was one of the other Republican candidates, and he mm-hmm. was like the major competitor in the Republican Party. And George W. portrayed himself as being a compassionate conservative, saying he was more centrist than other Republicans. Like, he kind of tried to play to that side of it a lot during the primary. He talked about wanting to bring integrity and honor back to the White House, which was totally a burn to Clinton, which I think is hilarious,
which,
and totally
again,
not
is
true.
Kind of funny coming from somebody who, like, didn't he get like a shit ton of like DWIs and like
oh, but like
George W. Bush had a very wild reputation for a long time.
But he didn't get blowjobs in the Oval Office, so he's gonna throw that. But like, it's true. Like, that was something that I think a lot of Republicans at that time probably like
pounced
looked
on,
at
course.
And pounced on. So with him making that joke, I mean, I found it funny. I wrote "burn" really big in my notes. So I can see why, you know, other Republicans would kind of jump on that bandwagon, especially because Al Gore was the vice president for Clinton. So also, before I move on to Al Gore, because I'm almost there, I want to talk about the fact that George W. Bush chose Dick Cheney, who was the former White House Chief of Staff and Secretary of Defense, to be his running mate. And this was
monster.
Kind of, he's a monster. And this was seen as being kind of a controversial choice for a lot of people. But it does make a lot of sense, especially if you know anything about George W. and if you've seen the movie Vice. they are completely different human beings, and they both work very differently, where I don't think a lot of the things would have happened in his administration had it not been for
Cheney. 100%. I mean, the thing is, yes, of course, Vice is a movie, and, you know, you have to take some of the stuff with a grain of salt, but the truth is that Cheney was a great political mind. He was an evil motherfucker, but he was a great political mind. George W. Bush was not, but George W. Bush was charismatic and seemed like, to quote Hamilton, you could have a beer with him. How many times did you hear people say that? And he does. He gives off that vibe that, like, you want to hang out, you want to have a beer, you want to eat a steak.
Max says that to this day, and I'm like, I will not be in attendance. Fuck that man. I hate
him. Well, yeah. I mean, like, the thing
like,
is,
like, he seems cool, but I hate him. Fuck him.
He has a, if he wasn't the president making decisions that cost people their lives, but he has that kind of personality. Cheney has the personality of a fucking doorstop. He's trash. So
trash.
Together, you know, they made this kind of duo where it's like, you know, Trump or not Trump. Wow. Bush was going to be the face and Cheney would be the brains.
He'd be like the authority almost a little bit, you know, and I think it's almost, you know, it's funny that you say Trump, because I think we made a bit of a comparison, not necessarily to Bush and Cheney, but just a comparison of Trump and Pence at the beginning of this too, where it's like, you know, Pence is scary because he's smarter. You know what I mean? He's been in this longer. He knows what he's doing, where Trump is just kind of this stupid idiot. It kind of seems like a similar thing where it's the guy behind the scenes.
If only Pence had been forceful enough to be able to take those reins, you know, we would have seen something different.
My gosh, yes. All right, so let's move on to Albert Arnold Gore Jr.
Ol' Al.
He was born on March 31st, 1948 in Washington, D.C.
In Aries. Okay.
I love that you, I can't remember all of them. You're very good at like picking out people.
Wouldn't have pegged him for an Aries. I only know that because I'm a Pisces Aries, and so I know that he's right after me.
Oh, and George Bush is a Cancer. Don't trust male Cancers. I'm a Cancer. His birthday is 3 days before mine. Female Cancers are lovely. We're a little bit emotional. But male Cancers, if they're anything like my father, Lord help you.
I feel that way about female and male Pisces as well. But
really?
You know what? If we have male Pisces and Cancer listeners, we ain't mad at you. Just saying.
No. Although, I don't know. I've met a couple male cancers that are just very insufferable. So prove me wrong. I'm happy to be proved wrong. But maybe they're too similar to me. I don't know. Maybe just
my own. It's too late. They've turned the podcast off and they've walked away.
You're all insufferable. Sorry. Okay, so I take it back. I don't mean a word of it. So his dad was Albert Gore Sr., who was a U.S. representative who served for 18 years as a U.S. senator from Tennessee. So he comes from that political mindset as well. They actually have a lot of parallels, I feel, just in the way that they kind of had their political dynasties a little bit. His mom's name was Pauline, and she was one of the first women to graduate from Vanderbilt University Law School, which I thought was super...
Okay, get it, Pauline.
Right? So I had to add that in there. So Gore also attended Harvard, and he titled his thesis, The Impact of Television on the Conduct of the Presidency of 1947 to 1969.
Wow.
Which I think is kind of this interesting prelude to how the media... molded his own election in 2000. So I think that's kind of a fascinating foreshadowing.
He was an interesting one. I mean, again, for a lot of our younger listeners, like Al Gore, again, I really do feel like it played a factor. Unfortunately, we know that television does play a factor, you know, between the Nixon and Kennedy debates, right?
Yeah.
Where it's just like, whoa, Kennedy is way hotter than you. And that played a major, it played a major factor. And the same kind of thing is happened here. Like, Bush may not have been smart, but he was charismatic and charming. And Al Gore was boring. Like,
yeah,
Al Gore,
he was boring.
A snooze fest. And that man is smart.
Yeah.
He's real smart.
It's interesting though, because like if you look at, and I'll talk about this when we get closer to talking about the actual election, but the polling before, which again, you can't really buy into too much, but even if you look at, you know, how close the election was, he was really liked. Like a lot of people really liked him and were excited about him, which I find interesting because even though I knew that, you know, my parents were in line with his views and that's who I would have wanted to vote for, you know, if I was able to at the time, I don't remember thinking this guy was anything special.
I think a lot of people, I think he rode pretty far as well on being Clinton's vice president.
Very
much so. Because
even
though there was scandal at the end of Clinton's presidency, people still really liked him.
Yeah.
He was still a very likable person.
He was still a good president, too.
Yeah, and a lot of people thought that he was really unfairly attacked. So I think that Gore got a lot of traction from that as well.
Totally. Oh, I think being Clinton's vice president was, like, the reason that he probably made it, you know? He graduated cum laude in June 1969 from Harvard. He then helped his father write an anti-war address to the Democratic Convention in 1968, which is super cool. But this is funny that he stayed in the hotel room during the violent protests. He had a really big issue with like violence and things like that. So he decided to stay in the hotel room. He agreed that the war should end, but didn't agree with the protesters' tactics to get it done, which I'm kind of like...
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Where have we seen this before?
Exactly.
He's a very standard Democrat, right? Like a moderate, middle-of-the-road Democrat.
Right down the aisle, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So he began serving the U.S. Congress in 1977 when he was only 28 years old. And he would be there.
Yeah, that's my dude.
That's my age. It's got people making me feel old. And he would be there for 16 years until 1985, which is when he reached the Senate in Tennessee and stayed there until 1993. So he took his father's spot, which I didn't even realize until I read it out loud. Al Gore actually originally ran for president in 1988. Did you know this? Because I did not.
I did not.
Okay, so he first ran for president against Joe Biden.
Oh, my dear.
And just...
Man, God, they're so old.
I know, right?
I know. Joe Biden is so old.
And Jesse Jackson was another one of his running
mates. I remembered that, yes.
Yeah. And I literally wrote in my notes, oh, dear, he old as fuck. So Gore was not expected to win the primary, but if he had won, he was only 39 years old, and that would have made him the youngest serious presidential candidate since John F. Kennedy. And he finished third overall in the primary. So he wasn't unliked, but he did not make it all the way. And then came the 1992 presidential election when Clinton asked him to be his running mate, which apparently Gore was hesitant to do at first. But after seeing George H.W. Bush's administration on climate change, he wanted to run to do something about climate change.
Yes, and he's still a massive climate change advocate.
That's like his
he's
thing.
He's done so much research, and you know, we would not be as far along as we are without Al Gore, so we owe him a huge debt of gratitude.
And what I wrote next in my notes is, if Gore had been elected in 2000, I just wonder what kind of work he could have done on climate change and where the world would be today.
That's such an interesting point. I really feel like we would be much further along. But then again, the pendulum always swings, you know, because we had Carter, who actually put up solar plant panels on the White House, and then Reagan came in and the first thing the administration did was take them down.
Yep.
So, I mean, who fucking knows?
I know. So before the election started, Gore already had criticism of George W. Bush. You know, obviously their policies were very different. Gore was very anti-war, and the Bush administration, as we know, would not be. George H.W. Bush, that's something I learned very young. You know, my parents were like, he really wanted a war and he never got it. I think that was kind of this like tagline
yes,
that followed.
It was.
And I don't know what truth there is to that exactly, but I know that Bush was more supportive of war in the country.
It's a fact that wartime presidents are more popular, at least for a time. And we did see that. There was a time right after 9/11 when everybody was on board with Bush. And had Bush not gone on to a second term, I think, yes, there were still a ton of criticisms of him, you know, a couple years into his presidency. But I think that we would have thought differently of him because there was that period where we all were kind of like as Americans.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because Gore was vocal years later about talking about how he feels that Bush used the 9/11 tragedy as a justification to invade Iraq.
100%.
And was very 100%. Open about that. Yes. You know, it's just
Or Cheney did. Bush
too.
Is not smart enough to have done that. He's not.
He didn't think that true. He didn't think that through. Should we get into talking about the election itself?
Yes.
Election night.
So I do want to say that the 2000 presidential election was considered to be the most controversial in the history of the United States until right now.
Yeah, exactly.
So this election was held on November 7th, 2000. And on election night, there was no clear winner. So print and broadcast media cited contradictory exit polling numbers. And the races in Oregon and New Mexico remained too close to call for days. And, you know, both of us watched a documentary on YouTube called Endless Election. It's a CNN documentary. And it was very interesting to watch, you know, all of these kind of insiders and also all of these mostly, but not all, CNN broadcasters talking about what it was like to be working on this, because the polling was all messed up kind of from the beginning.
It was crazy, and nobody really knew what was going on. And I also remember people talking about, like, you didn't question what was put in front of you. Like, if this was given to you as news, you reported it, even if you had kind of these questions, you know?
I can't remember exactly what they said, but they did say, you know, yes, you trusted what was put in front of you because for years and years it worked and it was correct. But something had gone wrong in the exit polling numbers. So the information they were giving was not always correct. And different news sources or different networks were giving conflicting information.
And then feeding off of each other in a weird way.
Yes,
it was bizarre. Nobody knew what they were doing.
What they all kind of agreed on, though, not necessarily agreed on, but what was true was that on election night, even though we had some states, again, Oregon and New Mexico, several others that were too close to call and wouldn't be called for days, those states had relatively low electoral numbers. And so just like we kind of saw in this election, it would ultimately come down to a state that had a lot of electoral votes. And that state this time was Florida. Florida had 25 electoral votes. And, yes. you know, I was actually thinking this. I don't want to do this next week because I need a mental brain break from elections and politics.
Right.
But if our listeners are interested in having maybe a breakdown of what the Electoral College is and how it came about.
Yeah.
Let us know, because I know for years I was very confused about the Electoral College. And why our elections operate the way that they do, because other countries are not like that.
I mean, so it would have made this situation impossible. I don't think that this situation would have happened in 2000 or in 2020 had we just taken the popular vote.
100% would not have, because the margin of error wouldn't have been so slim.
Right.
Like, the margin of error in the 2000 election, as we'll get to later, but, I mean, the margin of error was about 500,000 votes.
Yeah.
This election, it's, like, going on 5 million votes.
Right.
But even with 500,000 votes, yes, some states may have needed to recount, and there might have taken some time, but the margin is so wide that it would have gone to Gore, right? Because there's 500,000 votes. And Biden would have won on election night, probably, if it was by the popular vote. And other countries do it by one person, one vote. And so if you are interested in knowing why we as Americans do it a completely different way, let us know. And we'll consider maybe doing an episode.
Yeah, we might, you know, maybe after the holidays. Let's give ourselves a little bit of a...
I need a mental break from even doing this one. I was like, oh my God, if I read the word electoral college one more time.
One more time, I know. So I read a few differing accounts, but I went with this one because I saw it on a few. They say that Fox News actually announced that Florida was going to Bush first at 2:17 a.m. And then CNN, ABC, CBS, and other networks kind of followed through after that. And then pretty soon after, like a few minutes later, they were like, just kidding, never mind, like it's too close to call. And then they called Gore as being the winner of Florida and then very quickly retracted that as well.
Yeah, it was pandemonium. Like from what I saw, they called Gore early on and Bush, and there's video of him kind of like in the hotel room or wherever he is.
Oh, of
refusing
Bush?
refusing to believe the reports.
He's in his government. What I wrote is, at this point, Bush is shaking in his cowboy boots at the governor's mansion.
Yes, there it
is. He's in Texas at the governor's mansion just freaking the fuck out.
And he's saying, he's like, because we now have a president who is like an absolute petulant child.
Yeah.
It's easy to look at this footage of Bush and be like, oh, he's being a baby about this. But in reality, I mean, everybody was like, what? Like, how can they call it so early? And so it makes sense that he was like, I don't believe it. I don't think we have all the votes yet. And so I'm refusing to accept that Gore won that state.
And that's what's crazy. So all of this is happening and they're going back and forth with who won, who didn't win Florida. And then Gore decides to call Bush.
Well, wait.
Oh, wait. So there's more things that happened first. Sorry.
Yeah. No. So it was around. Okay. So it swung to Gore, right? And then it swung back. And again, too close to call. That's the thing that everybody, we're going to say it probably a million more times. Too close to call. So it became too close to call once again. And then it swung towards Bush. So it was around 2 a.m. in the morning that it swung towards Bush. And Bush had opened an insurmountable, what appeared to be an insurmountable lead and had taken Florida. And so there were news agencies that were saying that he's taken Florida and thus been awarded the presidency because he has enough electoral votes.
Right.
However, again, it was conflicting information. And even people, when you watch this documentary, who were on Gore's team.
You mean Bush's team?
No. People who were on Gore's team hadn't really seen and or bought into that information.
Right.
So it was surprising to them that Gore called Bush.
Yes. And it's funny because, you know, these men did not like each other. So this conversation lasted about 10 seconds. You know, Gore got on the phone and was like, there you have it.
It was
a
congratulatory formality.
Exactly. But his running mate, Lieberman, does not know where Gore is. He doesn't know what's going on. He's freaking out.
My friend. I know. Why would you not tell your staff? Like, because there were people on his staff who were like, I would have advised against him conceding the election early.
The part that I loved in this in the documentary that we watched that I sent you, the CNN documentary, was when the numbers guy realizes, like, no, wait, what is he doing? Like, there's still time. And then who's the guy that's literally in charge of? There was somebody that was told, like, you need to go get him now. Like, literally, right, he was like running, trying to like reach Al before he reaches the stage.
So I just watched this today. So this is fresh in my brain.
Okay, good.
So he calls Bush to concede the election. And then an hour later, like, Gore's people got to him and they were like, hey, it's very apparent that the Florida race is much, much closer than we had originally believed. There were fewer than 600 votes that separated the candidates, and that margin appeared to be narrowing in Gore's favor. So at 3 a.m., he calls Gore. He's about to... Okay, so at 3 a.m., he is headed to the, like, stage to give his concession speech. Right, like, he is on his way, and then there's a member of his staff, you're right, like, the numbers guy, I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
But he is like, we have to get him, stop him, whoever's there with him, drag him away and put him in a room, let him go anywhere until I can get there. Because he was literally about to walk on the stage
to announce his concession. Who was the guy that actually, because it was the guy telling the story that was like, I grabbed him like as he was getting on the stage and was like, yes, what the fuck are you doing?
And he didn't pulled say that, him but. Into a room. Like, they basically grabbed Gore and shut him into a room and explained to him, there are fewer than 600 votes. The margin is narrowing.
Yeah.
And so it was at that time that he did something that was unprecedented before or since, I think. Called Bush.
Unprecedented. So I meant to send this to you so we could read this back and forth. It's not going to be as fun right now. But Bush, apparently on his end, just said, you mean to tell me, Mr. Vice President, you're retracting your concession? And Gore said, you don't have to be snippy about it. And then he said, let me explain something. Your younger brother is not the ultimate authority on this. Because, of course, who's the governor of Florida?
It's Jeb Bush.
It's George's younger brother, Jeb.
So what we can assume is happening in this conversation, because we really only have like one side of it, and it's the Gore side, is that, and this is also, I mean, there were people on Bush's side who were saying this is kind of how it went down, is you have Jeb Bush there assuring his brother George, like, yeah, no, you've won Florida.
Like, you've got this. Florida. Yeah.
So then you've got... Dumb, dumb George on the phone with Al Gore saying, but my little brother says I've won it.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, but my brother said, and he's like, no, your brother does not have the authority here. It was just, it's such a funny interaction. I just like that he said, you don't have to be so snippy about it.
So he retracted his concession, which I don't think has ever happened before or since.
Or since. Like, it's crazy. I mean, we've had a president not concede.
Yes, we've had a president not concede. We've had a president, you know, presidents not attend the inauguration of their, you know, successors. We've had all of these things happen. But, and, you know, I don't think we've ever had a president give a concession and then be like, take backseat.
Just kidding. You know? Well, and that, you know, I don't go into this much, but apparently that was a big point of contention during the next like 5 weeks of all this chaos, because people were like, oh, well, he conceded, so we really shouldn't be going through any of this at all. You know, we should have stayed in his concession.
And, you know, there was one member of Gore's team who had encouraged him to concede and was asked at the end of this CNN documentary, you know, do you regret having instructed him to concede? And he says, yes, I do regret it, because it set us up. You know, this whole thing, it's like a domino effect. One thing kind of led into another thing, and there were so many things at play.
And I've got to say, I put my tinfoil hat on a little bit at one point during this conversation, or not during this conversation, during this research. I'm a little bit, I don't know. I think some of this is kind of suspect. I find it very, very strange.
There are some things that are suspect, and we will talk about those for sure.
Yeah. So the United States waited 36 days to learn who would be their new president. I thought it was longer than that, though. I think some people are saying different things.
No, I think it was 36. I thought I had 36 or 37. So okay. It was around that amount of time.
But it's crazy. Because crazy. Really, because we had 5 days where we weren't sure and we were losing our goddamn minds.
Yes.
This was over right. a month of people being completely right. unsure of who their president was going to be.
So let's talk about a little bit of what happened during that yes. month. So Florida state election law required a mandatory statewide machine recount. And so by November 10th, so 3 days later, the machine recount was complete and Bush's lead still stood at 327 votes yes. out of 6 million cast. So I also want to put that into perspective for people. When you're trying to compare this election to the 2020 election, we're talking about a margin of a few hundred yeah. votes. Right now, Biden leads in several states by tens of thousands. It's not anywhere near close to the same. The margin of error is 327 out of 6 million. Yeah. So it's not anywhere
it's
near
not.
The same.
Well, and the thing is that because these margins were so low, again, like there is right now, there were a lot of people crying voter fraud, you know, a lot of people. But this time it was more on the Gore side where I feel like people were wondering why Bush was coming out on top because Gore had won the popular vote.
Gore had won the popular vote. And then also there were actual legitimate issues with this yeah. election. So there were court challenges issued over the legality of hand recounts in select counties where they were counting yeah. by hand, which of course leads to a margin of human error. And then county officials had to try to discern voter intent through, say it with me, hanging
yep,
chads.
Hanging chads.
How many times did we hear fucking hanging chads? Which was basically...
okay.
Yeah.
So I remembered hearing hanging chad a lot, as we just said, but I don't think I ever really...
There were Halloween costumes. People
yeah, well, How I Met Your Mother. Do you remember?
As a hanging
yeah,
chad.
Do you remember that episode?
Oh, yeah, that's right. They did do that.
And
in
he
How I Met
still
Your
went mm-hmm. as a hanging chad even like 8 years later or something like that because he wanted to meet the girl, the slutty pumpkin.
Yeah, that's right. When it was no longer relevant.
Exactly.
That's right.
So I never really thought about it. I thought it was just kind of like a nickname, but apparently a chad refers to the fragments sometimes created when holes are made in a paper. So like if you're doing the hole punch, the piece that falls out is called a chad, which I did not know. Maybe I'm just the last person on the planet to know this. So a hanging chad is when the chads are attached to the ballot at only one corner. So they're like hanging on for dear life, like about to fall off.
Right. So they're incompletely punched paper yeah. ballots. Like that was a big part of this. Like now we all vote kind of like electronically or we're like manually filling in bubbles. This was, and I voted this way before, where you have the little pen
punch
and
it
you
through.
Like punch
yeah.
through. And it was, there were
yeah.
issues. Issues were mistakes
Big
were
issues.
Made.
So a swinging chad is when the chads are attached to the ballot at two corners, tri-chads attached at three, and then pregnant or dimpled chads are attached to the ballot at all four corners, but have an indentation indicating the voter may have left a mark at that candidate. So,
right. Like they tried to push it through, but it didn't go
right.
all the way through.
So that is an issue for both hand counting and for the computerized counting. Now, Gore was more for the hand counting. He and his lawyers really, really pushed for the hand counted votes.
Well, in that way, it was easier to, and you have all these pictures, very famous pictures of poll counters holding up, you know, yeah. looking at the hanging chads, right? Because yes, like if you're a human with common sense and you're looking at a ballot and you're seeing that there is a hole punched through for Gore and there's a chad that's hanging on by one little
right.
corner, you're like, yes, clearly the person who was voting was
exactly.
voting for Gore.
Like, so
a machine might not be able
right,
to tell
so that
you.
Was kind of Gore's perspective, I think, with that is like he more so trusted that humans would see that and understand what the intent was for that voter. Where Bush really wanted these tabulating machines to keep running them, but there were lots of issues with those machines on election day and throughout the recounts. So they were kind of at a stalemate for a way to recount these ballots in a normal way, I guess.
Right. Well, and, you know, beyond the chad issue, there was a bigger issue, and this I can't fucking get over, the issue of the butterfly ballot
yeah.
design. Now, I cannot stress to you how dumb this design is. So this, I can't overemphasize that. I looked at this and I was like, I cannot believe that this was, this made it through all of these checks. So it was used in Palm Beach County, and it caused a lot of confusion for Gore voters because it had punch holes in the center of the ballot, and it prompted them to inadvertently cast their votes for a third party candidate named Pat Buchanan, a huge piece of shit.
I was going to say,
and
that
so
name.
He received... He's a terrible person. He received like 3,400 votes, which was 20% of his total statewide. It was very clear that this was a mistake because they were very close to each other. The design of this ballot made no sense. And in this documentary, people on both sides admit that. They say like, yeah, the design was terrible. However, it was designed by a Democratic elections director. And both Democrats and Republicans had signed off on this ballot design before the 2000 election took place. So Gore's team didn't really have a leg to stand on when it came to, you know, discounting those votes or like, because they had the opportunity. Democrats had the opportunity to say, no, this design isn't going to work. Before the elections took place, and they didn't do that.
And which is probably another reason why they wanted it done by hand, you know what I mean? So that it wouldn't continually be discredited and things like that.
So Gore's team felt that the game was rigged against them, which it makes sense why they would feel that way, because first of all, Jeb Bush was the governor at the time. And according to sources from that CNN documentary, no law firms in Florida would work for Al Gore because they were afraid of antagonizing this, again, very powerful dynastic family with one who happens to be the governor of their state. So you had that. And then you had good old Catherine Harris. Kathy. So she was the person in charge of directing the counties to re-canvass and retabulate the votes as was required by Florida law. However, she was also George Bush's campaign chair in Florida and the Secretary of State for Florida. So she was his campaign chair and was the person in charge of like making sure everything was done correctly.
It's so shady. And apparently the Bush campaign wasn't even that happy with her about her handling of the incident. I think they probably wanted...
That woman was vilified.
She was vilified. Hard. In her memoir, Center of the Storm, she says that they had hired someone to act as her handler after the election was over.
Which is kind of wild because by late November, you know, the Florida State Canvassing Board certified Bush the winner by 537 votes. And it was Catherine Harris
who announced
on TV that he had won this election.
Exactly.
You know, so it's kind of surprising to me that they were displeased with her handling.
I guess it was maybe just through the whole process. And even though she ended it well, they just didn't like how she handled the entire thing.
I kind of got the vibe that maybe they thought she was being too nice because they interviewed the guy who worked with her and he was like, look, we're not going to break any. He said this in the interview. He was like, we're not going to break any laws, but we're bringing it for Bush. So buckle up, Kathy, because we're doing what we got to do. You know?
Which is another reason why I'm like, this is kind of shady. So eventually, the Florida Supreme Court had to get involved, and they ordered a recount of undervotes, which is a ballot that was not counted because of the unclear marking, in all 67 of Florida's counties. They examined the election machines, voter lists, vote counting rules, Florida's shitty election statutes, partisan election officials, and the roles of the courts.
Okay, so once they were through with that, it had reduced Bush's lead to a mere 154 votes. And the Bush campaign quickly filed an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court, asking it to delay recounts until it could hear the case. And a stay was issued by the court on December 9th. 3 days later, concluding that a statewide recount could not be performed in time to meet the December 18th deadline for certifying the state electors, the court issued a very controversial at the time, 5-4 decision to reverse the Florida Supreme Court recount order. And this effectively awarded the presidency to Bush. And this was historically the first time that the U.S. Supreme Court had intervened with election.
This seems shady as fuck to me. I even Googled 2000 election conspiracy, and I didn't see anything about this, but there's got to be conspiracy theories out there, because from what I read, it seems like the more conservative judges backed Bush while the more liberal judges backed Gore, which led to questions about whether or not it was appropriate for the court to intervene at all. So it just seems...
Well, that becomes the issue, though, because the Supreme Court is supposed to be bipartisan. They take a pledge that they will be bipartisan, but we all know that
they're not.
I know,
and that's the thing that pisses me off, is knowing that the conservatives were backing Bush and that the liberals were backing Gore. Like, I don't think either party was correct in doing so. You should be bipartisan and looking at things objectively.
Right. But I think the argument that people on the other side of the aisle will make is that the Florida Supreme Court tilted liberal. And so I think that they think that calling for another recount, which is what the Florida Supreme Court did, was because it tilted liberal. And so then when it went to the Supreme Court, which tilted conservative, they made a conservative call. This is the problem with our politics. You know, this is why we fear somehow in this 2020 election, it making it to the Supreme Court, because they are so conservative.
They would side with Trump.
Right. And even though they all take pledges to be nonpartisan, we all know that that's just not the truth. It just isn't.
I mean, man, when this thing was over, it was tight. Bush only led Gore in electoral votes at 271 to 266.
271. So I want to remind everyone that you only need 270 to win. Or that's what you need. You need 270. He had 271. It was only one electoral It was only one electoral vote more than what was required. It's insanity. Yeah. And again, as we said, Gore won the popular vote over Bush by 500,000 votes. And it was the first inversion of the electoral and popular vote since 1888. Of course, we have seen that happen many times.
Can I give another history lesson?
Your hand is raised.
Can I give a history lesson? Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit about Rutherford B. Hayes, because this was another example of kind of a bizarre election conclusion, and I think it kind of fits in best with what we're talking about. So, the election of 1876 was also decided by Congress, since the Constitution didn't have an answer to this particular problem at the time. So, Democrat Samuel Tilden won with 184 electoral votes, but I think they meant 184 more electoral votes. And he was one vote shy needed for the majority at the time. And Hayes won 165. But then there were still 20 electoral votes that were still in dispute. And they couldn't figure out where those electoral votes were going to go. So these 20 electoral votes that were in dispute were none other than Florida, of course.
Surprise. Florida,
always making trouble. And they brought along their buddies this time, Louisiana and South Carolina. So that's where the votes were kind of unsure of where they wanted to take this presidency. So Congress created a bipartisan federal election commission made up of the House of Representatives, senators, and Supreme Court justices, which voted to give the 20 votes to Hayes. Historians believe there was a deal brokered between the parties to make this happen, which sounds like that's probably what happened. So the Democrats let Hayes become president in return for the Republicans promising to pull all federal troops from former Confederate states, which does make a lot of sense to me. But I thought that was really interesting, because it was kind of all of these different political groups and parties kind of coming together and deciding to give all 20 of these votes to one person, rather than having it be like a recount or finding, like, doesn't that just seem bizarre to you?
That's interesting.
So that just reminded me of when I was thinking about my possible Supreme Court conspiracy theory with the 2000 election. It just made me think of that, because, like, it seems like there really was this deal going on behind closed doors as a way to get the Confederate troops out of the South, they kind of just gave the presidency to Hayes. So it's kind of off topic, but I thought that was interesting, so I wanted to add that in there.
No, it's interesting. It is interesting. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know me with conspiracy theories. I tend to tread lightly. However, I mean, I will say, and I don't even think it's disputed. Like, I feel like with the 2000 election, even in that documentary, they talk to people on Bush's team who say, I think Bush won from the number of votes cast. Uh-huh. I think Gore won for the number of votes intended. Like, they basically say
it's
that.
It's so like,
because things were messed up in Florida, right? Like, that Gore really should have won. But if we're counting the legitimate votes that were cast, then Bush would win. Now, I think that that is why a lot of Republicans, and also Trump, because he's dumb, I think that's why they have this belief that it could happen now, it could happen
which
here.
Which is why they're holding
because
out.
It happened then. Right, because, and that's why they keep saying things like legal votes or legitimate votes, is because even though Gore should have won that election, he didn't have enough quote unquote legitimate votes. But the difference is the margin between Bush and Gore, it was one state of, you know, large electoral numbers, but one state nonetheless, and a margin of error of a few hundred. Yeah. We have something like 4 or 5 states that are in dispute right now with tens of thousands of votes. So it's not the same situation whatsoever.
What's crazy is that there have only been 5 presidents through history that have won by only getting the electoral votes, that they have not won the popular votes. And Trump is one of them. Bush is another one of them.
Twice.
Trump twice. Yeah. Well, but he didn't win the second time.
But he didn't win this one. Twice he has lost the popular vote.
Yeah, he is one of the only presidents, 1 of 5, that have ever won and not gotten the popular vote.
This is why the Republican Party will never abolish the Electoral College.
Right.
Because they can't win without it. Because in the last however many elections, they have lost the popular vote. They have lost the popular vote since Bush, I think.
Yeah.
So they know they cannot win the presidency if they're not relying on the Electoral College. If it is simply a numbers game, one person, one vote, a popularity contest, essentially, for who people in this country want to be their leader, they will lose. And that should bring everybody a little bit of comfort. Yeah. What that actually says is that this country is far more aligned with you than you might think, looking at who's in charge or what's on the news. It is leaning progressive. It wants to go that direction. If given the opportunity, it will, because that's just progress. That's the nature of progress. So I want to take this opportunity right now to again say to any of our listeners from Georgia, especially our very young listeners, our listeners who might be 18 before December 5th. I think it's December 5th. Double check that date. Don't rely on me.
I believe you're right. But I think it is November 5th, if I'm remembering correctly as well.
Or December.
December 5th.
December 5th, I think. Because
to check. There's no way. We're being too confusing.
We've got to check. But you should also check yourself. If you are 17 right now, basically, check. Because if you are eligible to vote, please register to vote in Georgia. Because we need to take control of the Senate. Because that is the only way that we will have any chance of abolishing the Electoral College and allowing each person's vote to actually
matter.
Mean
I know
the same
I
as
know.
Everybody else's.
Like, the Electoral College is outdated and it just needs to go. But before 100%. We go, Keegan, I don't think you ever talked about the slow transition of power being one of the reasons. Really quick before we get to the end of the episode. I want to talk about that.
So that's really more of an aside, but I did mention it on our mini episode. And it was just kind of an interesting fact that I found whenever I was looking up. If you haven't listened to our mini episode, I was talking about kind of Trump trying to block the Biden administration from being able to access all of the information they need in order to transition into the presidency. And a part of the reason why that is so important is because it took so long for this to be figured out, the 2000 election to be figured out, because we wasted essentially almost 40 days trying to figure out who was the president. Not wasted. It was necessary. But because it took almost 40 days, by the time it was announced that Bush would be the president to the time that he was inaugurated, it was a very small window of time. And so they weren't given the same amount, the same transition period as another candidate would be given. And that transition period is vital for relaying important national security information. And so there was an official report on the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks that warned that the shortened transition period contributed to a lack of preparedness on the day. So it just goes to show you how important it is that our election process function quickly, smoothly, easily, that we have a peaceful, smooth transition of power from one president to the next, because any wasted time could have devastating consequences. Now, I'm not saying that it would have worked out differently necessarily.
Right. It still would have happened
on September 11th. Right. I don't know the details or the ins and outs, but I do know that it was important enough for them to highlight that in an official report on the terror attacks of September 11th, that this shortened transition period was a real issue and led to real issues down the line.
Yeah, because, I mean, this happened fairly quickly into his presidency, right?
Very quickly. So, you know, that election took place in November of 2000. He was finally confirmed as the president-elect in December, was inaugurated in January of 2001, and then in September. So he's a new president.
It's crazy. I can definitely see where having had all of the information and also just having more experience as the president, I'm sure would have been more helpful at that time. As much as I despise the guy, I do think that in the actual moment of when the attacks happened, I do think that he handled that as well as one could have. I just have a lot of issues with everything he did afterwards.
Here's the thing, controversial opinion coming at you, hot takes. I don't think that Bush is a bad person. Like, I actually don't. And I don't think he's a bad, I don't think he's a bad human being. Like, I don't think that he is an evil person. And I don't think that he means, I think that he probably means well. I just think that he is an easily led person, and that made him a very bad leader. And unfortunately, being a bad leader in a country that has the most powerful military in the world leads to disastrous consequences that costs a lot of people their lives. And we cannot sweep that under the rug or forgive that just because he seems like a nice old man who likes to paint pictures.
That's my,
you know what I mean?
That's like, my thing is that I think too many people like to plead ignorance with him. And while I very much agree with that, I don't think he's a bad person. I don't think he's evil. I also was raised in a home where my dad spoke very vocally about his hatred for the man and why. So I have just this very deep-seated like resentment toward him and dislike, which is why even when Max is like, oh, I would love to like sit and have a beer with him, I'm like, I just can't. I can't look at the man without thinking about all the lives that he destroyed.
I haven't read about this in a long time, but it did stick with me when I read about it years and years ago. And it was, they talked about it in regards to the Holocaust and World War II, and it was the banality of evil, right? It's like, evil is boring. It's not necessarily, like, it's not a Bond villain. It's not somebody sitting there, like, nefariously, you know, plotting. And while I think Cheney might be dangerously close to that.
I was going to say, Cheney might challenge you there.
Bush is not that. He isn't that. Like, he is probably somebody who always wanted daddy's approval. And so he became the president of the United States. Something terrible happened and he got in over his head. Right? Like, he was probably hoping to have 4 years of just like super chill presidency so he could get out, make daddy happy, and go on to live a good life as a weird old man who can't get his rain poncho on. But unfortunately, that's not how it worked out for anybody.
I know, and unfortunately, we had 8 years of him. But then we had Obama. Yeah. But Oh boy.
Then we had Trump. So it swings, the pendulum swings. These are the days of our lives. Yes, they are.
But I had a good time revisiting this, especially because it was something that was on my mind so much leading up to this election. I am glad, however, that we got a bit of a break between last week and this week of our notes a bit of talking about this as well, and now having a full picture of what the election looked like and kind of where we are now. It's interesting to see how history has treated some of these disputes in the past. So I hope that you all really enjoyed this as much as we enjoyed talking about it. If you have anything that you would like for us to talk about, any topic ideas, go ahead and shoot them our way at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com or direct message us on Instagram at @angryneighborhoodfeminist. We have a Twitter that we sometimes use at YAMF Podcast,
YANF
Podcast. We have a Facebook business and group page. You can rate and review us on the business page and chat with the other listeners on the group page. You can also rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. That is how you can help us out the most. And last but not least, if you don't already, go ahead and listen to us on Radio Public. It is a free way for you to listen, and it helps us out just a tiny bit. All right. With all that being said, we encourage you to rage on.
Bye.